This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
I'm not going to do big and long introductions on folks, but I will mention that Nick has recently finished a master's on Arthur Russell's music, and include that came out of a reconstruction and a performance of a piece that last 2 years ago at the AIDS Memorial. I think he's ready. So he's gonna sing from Whispering Pines.
Julia says he won't need to sit in Luna. The only forest name that I could think of is butterfly. I believe my question is, what is your tree? And what I mean by that is, I lived in an over 1,000-year-old ancient redwood tree in California. For over 2 years, without touching the ground, to keep this redwood tree from being cut down. And when I ask people, what is your tree? It doesn't mean life. What tree will you climb? But what is it in your life that calls you to be bigger than what you thought was possible for yourself and your world? What is it that calls you to stretch beyond what's comfortable into the places that are uncomfortable, and then to realize you are more powerful and magical than your mind could ever have believed. Thank you.
can be handed over from my left to the right if folks are understanding, just so you get a sense of what. So the next thing we're going to do is watch a film, about 15, 16 minutes long. Jennifer, Alora, and I were in the Whitney program together, and I apologize in advance if any of you went to a film screening I put together a couple years ago called El Porvenir Puerto Riqueño, because I showed it there. I love this film, and it's also in the book. So let's go ahead and watch that. We'll have the lights down.
Is there a blue light on the projector from the bottom?
There's nothing on the projector now.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. It's not the right color. I think it's going to change in a second, so let's go back.
Yeah, it's 1 minute.
Thank you.
ran out of chairs. Maybe to use a little suggestion, if you don't mind. So I'm going to just briefly introduce my panelists. Sarah Reisman, I met at the Witte program more than 20 years ago, and she's name-checked on the first page of the book because she brought me to the Water Pod in 2009, and we spent the night there together, which was the very, very, very beginning of this book. So it's been a hot minute thinking about these issues. And then Trevor Paglen, we went to Berkeley together, and we didn't know each other, though I have this sense that it's some North Side punk party. We probably were in the same room, but we got to know each other over the years, and sometimes see each other more in tropical places, randomly running into each other at surf breaks. So, I know, random. I'm happy that they're here to join us in talking a little bit about this book. So we'll talk for, half an hour, 40 minutes or so, and then there'll be some time for questions as well.
That sounds like a song. Sort of, kind of. Yeah. So I'll start just as the moderator. First of all, I'm the layperson in this group, so I will ask the questions to tease out some of the complexity that is less familiar to me. But my first question is for Eva. So when we were at the moment when we went to the Water Pod in 2009, that was a project that Mary Madeline staged around New York City for 6 months, demonstrating sustainability on an 80-foot-long barge that went to like different locations for 2 weeks at a time. And we did sleepover. We had dinner. We went canoeing on the Bronx River with kind of almost like palisades of garbage on each side. It was really impressive. And so there were other projects that you wrote about soon after that in a Gray Room article or essay that was including Oscar Tuazon's City Without a Ghetto, Niels Norgren's work that was at Governor's Island. Some of you may remember he did a drop city installation of tents. A number of other projects, but I just wanted to start at the beginning and if you could elaborate, first of all, what motivated you to do the book, but also how that connects to The Experimenters, which is your first book.
Thank you. I mean, this book has been gestated for a while as I was working on my Black Mountain College book. I felt I came down quite harshly on Buckminster Fuller. He was one of the three figures that I covered in The Experimenters. And I was very suspicious of the technocratic utilitarianism that he espoused. At the time, I was a full-time curator, and I was meeting with a lot of artists and mentioning my work on Black Mountain College and my struggles with Fuller. And it was really through the practice of artists' work and their enthusiasm about Fuller that I began to rethink my own criticisms, which really took this book for that to fully gestate. So the possibility that Fuller offers not just an ad hoc construction architecture that can be less permanent, but that can involve in a democratic way larger populations in terms of its construction and possibly its dissemination is a hugely important thing to look at. And many of the projects I cover in this book do that, but also the kind of overarching ambitions of a Fuller social justice project, which is to feed, house, and clothe the world's population with the resources that we have. Now there's problems about the kind of post-scarcity logic that he came out of in the 1950s and 60s, but there's just so much potential there to think about justice and about redistribution and about using technology to do that. And so that was really the kind of an origin for this. I mean, over 8 chapters, beginning with the terrestrial, which has a lot to do with the legacy of the geodesic dome in terms of forms of information display, filmic display, exhibition practices around that, but also ways of thinking about surveillance technologies. And Trevor's work became a bridge in joining the terrestrial to the extraplanetary in the ways that the second half of the book go into the, you know, the problems today of what we're doing with technology, particularly with the privatization of outer space, exploration, space tourism, or, you know, the sort of fantasy of artificial ecologies that will supersede, you know, the plentitude of our Earth and the casualties that are going to result from that. So, you know, that has been really the kind of arc of making this project happen.
So let me ask this. We've had this, is it an, I don't know if it's an argument that we've had, what we call it an argument, but early on in these conversations about dome culture, Ava would say the dome is inherently democratic in its form and its impact, and I said, how? I don't understand. I don't get it. Why is the dome inherently democratic? And I'm not sure if those are the words you've said, but that's what I understood. What is it? What is it imbued with that for you that it carries this potential for change, for social change?
Well, I think in the hands of artists and some kinds of architecture practitioners in the vein of Fuller, you know, it's a easily constructed, you know, form of architecture that, in its ambitions, in Fuller's sort of cosmology, would take us, you know, would be nomadic, but also would possibly be something to think of as, you know, a way to spacestead. Okay, so that's, you know, that there's problems to, again, thinking about, you know, junking Spaceship Earth and moving on alternate architectures. And of course, space is, you know, utterly reliant on infrastructure and architecture. You know, it's a completely technologically administered way of living. But I think that there are aspects in that much more in the terrestrial, I guess, of the way that the dome, you know, particularly in its legacy in the counterculture in the 60s, was a way to imagine a new form of collectivity in which, like, the production of space together would, you know, sort of mirror in a way a kind of, you know, like, sense of the mind, like the dome is the cranium and the celestial simultaneously, and that that kind of lattice network that the dome is constructed by had a metaphor of, you know, those forms of connection between people, in the synapses of the mind, and the way in which, you know, this transmute into, you know, potentially greater societies off planet. So I think that, you know, makes it something, one of the rare forms of the 20th century that really has the, you know, sort of purchase on a wider form, at least in architecture, of like how many people built their own domes. And there's problems to that, and let me know, I go into many of them in the book around the countercultures sort of buying into some aspects of Fuller's fear of urban spaces and the kind of suburbanizing or extra urban you know, way that many communes,
you did convince me. I wasn't unconvinced. I just think it's an interesting proposition, like that an architectural form has that capacity. I'm going to shift to Trevor, just to talk about the fact that your work engages with outer space and the sky, and something you wrote to us before the talk was the sky as the night sky as a mirror. And in your work, you track and photograph satellites that are typically, not typically acknowledged by the United States. So these satellites are cataloged and observed by an international network of amateur satellite observers that you use to calculate the position and timing of overhead transits. And I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about what information you can glean. Like, what do you get from tracking these movements in the night sky that we, like, I can't perceive? Maybe others here totally get it, but.
You can perceive them, but yeah. You just have to know where to look in one. And there's a kind of text to the sky, right? So there's, you can go on and on about the sky or space being a mirror or whatever, but this is the sky is one of the places that we've looked to forever to ask, who are we, where do we come from, where do we go?
Right.
So you can look at Babylonian cosmology, or you can look at like the James Webb Space Telescope. So I guess for my satellite tracking project, yeah, it's a project to track secret satellites, model their orbits, predict where they'll be in the sky, and photograph them. And so in terms of what can we glean from that, I guess there's two metaphors there. I mean, there's a metaphor about thinking about the ways in which when we look at the sky, are we seeing something different than like Van Gogh's Starry Night or like ancient cave paintings, right? So what is the intervention? What is the thing that you see as opposed to this point? Right? I guess on the other hand, when you go into the space of space, in other words, if you leave Earth and you get into orbit, the physics change very dramatically. On one hand, you know, you have bodies that are governed by, you know, Kepler's laws of planetary motion, for example, right? Those are not laws that govern our, you know, everyday lives. So you get this very different topology. But you also enter time in a very different way. You know, you move from a kind of time of everyday life or a time of generations or even geologic time, and you enter into a kind of solar time or galactic time or cosmic time, which is very, very different than our everyday experiences of it. And so these are some of the ideas, I guess, that I'm playing around with.
So a question for both of you is to do with the colonization of space and privatization of space. What did I want to ask about that? What are the ways that can be kind of prevented, or like in your research, Ava, did you find examples of projects that subvert that?
Yeah, certainly, and the second half really showcases that by kind of moving from Fuller into using Sun-Ram and Afrofuturism as a model of imagining what the needs of space are and what the problems of the recycling that we have now, the language of colonization so unproblematically by our white billionaire tech overlords who are now, you know, hell-bent on, you know, space studying and space mining, space tourism. So why, you know, what is redeemable about space is that we've always been looking at it and it's not owned by them, even though they are making claims on that. There's a kind of pageantry around what to do with space that Afro-Latinx, Sino, and indigenous futurisms offer. That is not about really physically going there, but like inhabiting that space as our future to make that possible and to not allow the future to be completely owned by those who have the technology, and that there are, you know, possibilities for reorienting the future, you know, and our possibilities in space, though, you know, my personal, you know, desire to go to space is minimal to zero, but, you know, like, and also just as a like sort of minor point to think about futures differently. Because for example, for Sun Ra, interplanetary travel was his past, right? He'd already been there, you know? That cosmology is about white people taking or wanting to take what he already had from, you know, for their future from his past. So it just kind of inverts, you know, some of our sort of flows around power and around technology that I think is a really important thing, you know, this moment in which this is really happening, you know, these people are really trying to have a scorched earth so that they can have a completely, you know, bought existence of that technological dependence, which is just terrifying to me and to, I think, probably many people, is that, you know, that's what we have to fight. And so I think it's really important in those projects that artists are the kind of forefront of, like, exploring that research of the future and giving us options about how to create a new imaginary around that and not allow it to be liquidated, you know, into Elon Musk.
Do you want to add anything?
Yeah, no, I completely
weird feeling to me that space is just about space as this. It's actually not space travel, it's not space colonization, which I think is ridiculous, you know, I mean, for a million different reasons. I don't think space is in danger of being privatized just because you will die. If you spend too much time there, your biological does not support the unit. But you're absolutely right, it does create a backdrop for imaginary worlds, right? It creates a backdrop for stripping away as many taken for granted as you can, like, remove yourself from. And that was a really good book in the film, right? The Arecibo message, like that. The project of trying to communicate with the alien is the project of examining yourself and trying to figure out how many taken for granted you can undo in order to try to imagine the world in a more diverse way.
It's a very optimistic conversation. I mean, and building on the screening and the music, it's moving, I think. I do want to ask a question about the title of the book. You have this subtitle, Art Techno-Utopia and Other Science Fictions, and I want to understand how you see art as science fiction, the other science fictions.
Yeah, I mean, continuing with that thought of, like, what is a performance of the future that artists offer us, you know, that's often what we imagine science fiction to be. And, you know, it's fiction itself has this kind of literary, you know, substructure, right? But I think that there's something about, you know, these projects that allows us to, you know, construct alternate realities. And that's really the hope, you know, that I have, and the excitement that I have in writing about them is to you know, be there. And I think after Spaceship Earth, you know, for me, I end on a chapter called Mothership Earth, which would be an alternative I'm offering. But to, you know, to think about, you know, what is it for those who stay, right? We will be the remainders, you know, in this move, however frenetically insane it is to imagine the asperity of space being something to, you know, to desire as an alternate, or as an artificial ecology, as an alternate planet or whatever. But, you know, there's something, you know, about stewardship, you know, of this planet that I think is really important to return to, and the technologies, you know, on offer, at least within artistic, you know, as reflected in certain artistic projects that I, you know, go into in the book, I think is really powerful, you know, to provide us sort of roadmaps for, you know, for futures that are more just, you know, that are more ecologically sustainable. Sustainability isn't really the language I use, but, you know, ecologically, or just a sort of holistic treatment of, you know, how we can live in the future, you know, and how we can live together in a sort of posthumanist way as well as this, you know, film, you know, goes into, is that, you know, there's just such a sort of simplification with so much of the way technology has been, you know, abetting humans, you know, propagation, particularly capitalists, you know, like, sort of consolidation, you know, around certain humans' wealth, and what can we do instead, you know, and that I think is something that, you know, science fiction has often proposed alternate and sometimes dystopian forms of experience for us to contemplate. But I think it's important to return to what Frederick Jameson was positing around science fiction, is that it's really important to maintain a utopian imaginary because the alternative is pretty dire. You know, it's not dystopia, it's actually anti-utopianism, which is the world that we live in now, which is the foreclosure around thinking alternate futures at all. So I think that's where we really need to kind of think that power of the science fiction, of the alternate or speculative art, whatever we want to call that, you know, hope for, you know, having purchase on a better future, and that our, you know, our actions matter, of course they do, but, you know, just these are roadmaps that allow us ways to do that.
Yeah, I think about that a lot, like that there's that quote that's always attributed either Zizek or famous or Jameson, that's about it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the capitalism. No, we imagine, like, the end of capitalism all the time in science fiction. Talk to any UFO person, they would imagine the end of capitalism.
So maybe a kind of practical question, or it's not quite practical, but in both of your practices and research, there's a through line of critique about the sustainability of technology, outer space, like the way we get to outer space, and its impact on the future. So we've kind of established that in the conversation so far. How do you, I don't know if evaluate's the right word, but how do you understand the sustainability of an artwork, a contemporary work of art or design? How do you gauge the sustainability of that in the way that you're writing or identifying works to address?
I'm going to turn it over to Trevor because I want him to talk about the orbital reflector and it's precisely not being something that continues in, you know, that has an arc of its own kind of self-destruction.
The orbital reflector project was a project to launch, you know, a reflective balloon essentially that was last 6 weeks was the design life of it. And yeah, it was meant to be temporary, meant to open up essentially. And it was really, it was kind of weirdly, it was really influenced by Malevich, right? Who's, I'm not a space historian, but I think that he's one of the first people to theorize the idea of satellites. And there's a 1901 text where he's talking about wanting to put artworks in rings around the Earth, between the Earth and the Moon. He called these proposed artworks Sputniks. So fun and weird story there. But you know, I guess I've done two projects in space that are sort of on two opposite sides of that question. The sustainability, so the orbital reflector is super temporary. It's just meant to be, I was thinking about it as a public sculpture for public space, right? Then another project called The Last Pictures, which is essentially an artifact that's on a geostationary satellite. It's very far away from Earth, and it just goes around there forever. And so that was a project that was thinking through this question of the ways in which we intersect, whether we like it or not, with these forms of time that are very deep, that exist on the time scales of stars, rather than, you know, nations or continents or lifetimes or what have you. And the question is, can we think about some kind of ethical framework within which to acknowledge that? Because we're already making interventions in that space. And it's a deep paradox, because on one hand, you kind of can't, but then on the same, but then you have an ethical question about how hard you try. And what assumptions you bring to that effort.
So I think I'll ask one more question and then we can open it up to the audience if there's questions from any of you. I want to bring it back to Fuller and the notion of total design. I think in the book there's this idea of the Fuller effect that you explore, and I want you to maybe elaborate on how artists have inherited and re-examined Fuller's experimental model of total design.
Yeah, I mean, that's, that again is like that starting point by trying to get, to kind of prize Fuller out of the technocrats' stranglehold, and then return to, you know, to this kind of grand hope he had of a better world, right? That was, you know, he was part of his time, of course, you know, the language of space that he, it was just thick on the ground in the 60s, right? It was like, we're going to space, you know? I mean, and that, has its own problems too. So that's where the book has this kind of hinge around terrestrial to extraplanetary and, you know, sort of Fuller in the sense of these, you know, the dome projects, and then in the sense of what these, you know, these hopes for colonies in space, and then again, like, why do we need to use this language of the colony, and what are the stakes of that today that are really great, because obviously we haven't quite metabolized our history of colonization on Earth, and the perception that there are not other beings in space like has sort of neutralized that around the violence of colonization and enslavement, and it's kind of twin projects of progress. So, that I think is really where I think in contemporary art, the fuller effect, to continue with that phrasing, is really important to trace, because it contends with, the possibility of technology being, a very bad one, and then also has, the language of someone like Stuart Brand would have been calling it appropriate tools, which we now know, given the history of, Silicon Valley, tech, is turned into privatized tools, the PC primarily, but and then the way in which we experience the internet now is a largely anomic space and isolating one. So, I think there can be something else about appropriate tools as the hopes of some, community around the whole Earth catalog and the forms of, alternate futures that were possible then, that many artists are recovering and trying to find threads into, some of that optimism of a better world while leaving behind those problems. I like that. It's a good way to open it up.
Yeah. Do you want to add anything, Trevor? You're good. Any questions?
There's a mic here.
Just toss it to you. The mic throw.
Do you guys think that there's a coming overview effect? I believe Frank White wrote about the overview effect. If we were all able to see the Earth from orbit, how would that change our view without delineations of space and all that kind of stuff? And here we're talking about life, and it can go further than that, but we have the Clipper that's planning to land and have samples by 2030, and do you think that there's going to be on that, and if so, how, on this planet that we were just talking about, not wanting, or it sounded like to me that your feeling was like not really wanting to get into the whole space colonization discussion because we have such a bad record with colonization and capitalism. So I guess I'm asking specifically, if we find life on Europa, how do you think that would change the world's view on that topic?
Representing the Earth was super important for Stuart Brand, who collaborated with Joe on O'Neill, he also, I think he might have been the O'Neill effect of putting all the astronauts in the Marvel movie. We'll have this amazing sense of awe and sublimity. And I think that technological sublime is part of the problem, is that we would need a system to see and render the Earth in order to experience it in some way that is caring, right? I think we can care for the Earth without having to physically, with rocket fuel, jettison ourselves outside of it. And I think that, and I'm not avoiding the sort of problems of colonization in this book, it's really about that in its second half. And many of the artists have taken that on quite directly. Sometimes going back to projects of alternate futures, let's just call them. So, ways of imagining the redistribution of technology more equitably so that countries that are poor might have access to space, which is really not in the historic project of outer space exploration. It was really rich nations that were able to, and if you weren't part of that, you were left out of the space race, right? So what are those alternative futures of that time that people return to now? It's like, what does it mean to have a an equitable distribution of space technology, let's say? And again, to just think of us as, a sphere, really, we all are in space all the time, right? We have an atmosphere that protects us from the harshness of space, but I think that's another one of Fuller's lessons, is that, we're in this kind of, we're on a moving thing. He wanted to think of it as a technological object, that is kind of autogenetic human creation, we can just make a new one, But I think we still can imagine ourselves creatively in space all the time. It's just that going beyond the protective envelope of our atmosphere is an interesting and problematic language of penetration, which I critique in an eco-feminist way, is to say, why do we need to dominate that space? Can we not enjoy it in ways that don't allow, that don't demand us propelling ourselves there physically?
I'm really glad you just mentioned alternative futures that were envisioned in the past, and I'm wondering if you could expand beyond just the distribution of technology, but actual, like, if you brought in Sun Ra and Afrofuturism, so those are alternative logics of the future and technology, and I know there's a wider spread than just Afrofuturism. There's indigenous imaginings. So I'm just curious if you could say more about that, because that's super exciting to think.
Maybe
we
could talk more about the Russians.
Well, I think the Russians are super interesting, but it's complicated. So I've been really, in the space project that I've done, I've been really interested by Russian space mythology, which is really different than American space mythology. So in American space mythology, it's like, you go to the moon and then you plant a flag and like you do some mining, right? It's like a recapitulation of the frontier. The Russian story is a little bit different. The first real work in Eros, kind of figuring out the physics of how you would do space flight, was done in Russia in the early 20th century by a guy named Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, who figured out how to do space flight orbits and things like that. And he was really influenced, as were many artists and engineers and scientists, by a guy named Nikolai Fyodorov, who was a kind of philosopher from the late 19th century in Moscow. And Fyodorov's proposal was that all human production should be organized in the service of a greater good. He called this the common cause. And he said, you know, it should not be materialism or the accumulation of wealth or what have you. What that common cause should be a selfless thing that we do for, you know, humanity, kind of meta-humanity. And what the features of the common cause should be are, one, that we should make ourselves immortal, and two, that we should resurrect every human who's ever existed. And in order to do this project, we're going to have to develop space flight, because we need to be able to go out into space to collect the particles of our ancestors that evaporated from the Earth and bring them back in order to reconstitute them. And once we've resurrected everybody who's ever lived, where will they live? Well, will they need, we need to have them be able to live on other planets and things like that as well.
That's like the Mormons.
So isn't it, in a real way, in that imaginary of what space flight is, you're going into your own ancestry as you leave the Earth, right? And so when you see a film, read a book like Solaris or a film like that, when you're going into space, you're going into your own memories, you're going into your own ancestries, and you're getting into this very complicated thing. Now, there's a lot of problems with this vision as well, that there is a kind of weird version of Christian eschatology to it, which is not, you know, our version of that, but for me, it's an interesting example of like that point that you made before, which is that space is this backdrop against which you can tell these kinds of stories that are very difficult to tell without being able to place them in an alien environment.
What about Russian and Eastern European aliens slash UFOs?
I mean, the figure of the cosmonaut is an interesting one, and it's, you know, at least within my knowledge of the CCCP's positioning about it, was like a near religious figure. So, you know, already going into this kind of mythologization, of course, American astronauts, U.S. astronauts have their own mythologies. But you know, I think that it's important to note that we all sort of like know this from the right stuff, but this was a military project, you know. So although I mourn in certain ways the, you know, the end of a civic project of outer space exploration that was based in national space programs, it still, you know, needs to be grounded in a space race that was a military one. So yeah, so if that doesn't answer your question, but I think to imagine what, you know, the difference is in terms of the representation of the astronaut. I can't really speak to the Russian vision of the alien. I don't know if you can.
No, that's outside my league. It's just more this, you know, it's not the frontier in the same way that it is.
I could project. Is it okay? Do you hear me? Okay. So when I was a young girl in the 70s in the Soviet Union, very serious scientists were saying that by 2000 we will be member, our civilization will be a member of intergalactic community, and we will of course control weather and everything, you see. And it wasn't, and on here we had Star Wars and United States, but now I think there is at least someone in this audience who grew up in the city and never saw night sky. We got to this point that we have people in urban areas that never saw night sky and don't really feel this connection. So, and now we have space junk. And I also an artist and have a big project about it. And don't you think that this exactly the cause of all, the, of all this, that we, at some point, we start to concentrate on the future and forget about what is going on. For example, what to do with space junk? It now it's actually dangerous to go to space because there is so much around that more than what we need. And astronomers actually complaining about these satellites and everything. We have much more problems than how, my question is how you can still be optimistic.
That might be. Right, I think a really interesting point that I wanted to ask you about too, which is that, like, on one hand, we're thinking about space as, like, really a, like a literary device that we can play with. Like, here's this like creative sandbox that we can play in, and we can imagine stuff in that sandbox that we can't if we don't play in that sandbox. On the other hand, you know, you're talking about space colonization and equal access to space, and that feels like a really different conversation to me. And I'm wondering if you see where those overlap and where those don't. In my mind, they don't overlap, actually.
I think making visible through art in some of the projects that I profile is precisely opening up that gap, you know, or like allowing that already open gap to be understood as one that can't be necessarily smoothed over with, like, you know, with the kind of pageantry of like that sandbox, right? It's like, let's pretend, you know, let's perform, but I think it's important in that performance that there's a reality that's being marked around, you know, who really does have the tools. And that can open up spaces to fight, you know, for those tools, or to fight for them to be used differently. So to get, you know, when I first wrote about the last picture project you did, where there is a kind of elegiac quality of like, that junk is going out there and it's going to outlive us, you know, and that, you know, that's, you know, that would be sad, right? But it's, you know, it's important to think that like, that's, you know, we still have time. You know, like the millenarianism, or as you said, the eschatology of thinking that we have to kick technology into hard, you know, high gear so that we can destroy the earth. Is, I mean, Brunel Latour talks about, writes about this, you know, or wrote about it. you know, in terms of like the tendency to want to, you know, have a kind of scorched earth, right, which is part of capitalism's like endless extraction and the, you know, the kind of fiction of endless growth, you know, is that you can just continue to take, and then when there's nothing left to take anymore, then you find somewhere else to mine, you know. And so it's the extractive thing is like, you know, deeply part of this destructive millenarianism, you know, just like, let's hasten the end times, you know, and get us off planet so that we can have, you know, like only the real rich people survive. But I think, you know, the many projects and, you know, that's, again, what the second half of the book takes up in various ways, you know, try to say that that gap between, you know, trying to perform something and then also to sort of in your failure, I guess, to get to space, like still mark that there is something important about trying to have an equitable society that would have allowed you to do that for real, you know. Though you can't actually, as like, let's say the Zambian, you know, national, you know, space agency be an astronaut, which was a proposal in the early 1960s. But artists that, you know, return to something like that are thinking very importantly about what does it mean to be a black person in technology, or let's say in indigenous cultures, you know, to say, what if Sky Woman, you know, the origin of the earth was actually from a futuristic, you know, society where the tree of life, when it dies, is like a sort of electricity problem, you know, and then Sky Woman falls to earth as the first astronaut. So it's not just a feminist project, but one of sort of connecting, you know, visions of like better futures or sort of recovery of different imaginations of like our origins and our place in technology.
So I'll ask one last question, and I see Luca Bavoli has a question. Do you want the microphone? Would you be willing to take it?
Thank you very much for the lecture, for the panel discussion, and for your work. I look forward to see to read the book, and I know your world travel. I had a question about has your project, your conception of space altered since you began your interest into that?
Can I ask a quick question on that? I wondered if both of you have thought about cosmoglossia and the relationship between, it was such a utopian part of, you know, the early space race and the birth, the language of parrots and the language of aliens.
Cosmoglossia, you mean like universal language?
Yes.
Yeah, the image that opens the second half of my book is of Jeff Bezos in front of an enormous phallic rocket of his Blue Origin company. And I saw in 2015, I read an article in the New York Times about the Blue Origin purchasing launch pad in Cape Canaveral. I'd already been working on this, but it was interesting that at the end of, I ended up tracking down the actual press conference where he unveils the big rocket, and you know, he says, "I look forward to having a press conference with you in space." And I wonder, who is you? You know, the panel was of course all white men. The civic leaders of Florida, whoever sold him this stuff, you know, which was, it's like the way when the USSR collapsed, right, and you see like Roman Abramovich's like massive yacht, that was the patrimony of a struggle, right, that was then privatized, you know, all of those oil reserves, right, were turned into one man's yacht, but like the struggle of the Russian Revolution, you know, was real, and now we have this, and so we sold Cape Canaveral to Elon Musk, you know, we sold it to Jeff Bezos, and, you know, I think that galvanized me to think about, okay, what are these alternatives? You know, so that's where the real sort of like work into like what's a way that we can reclaim the future outside of this nightmare of colonization of space tourism, the space mining of the artificial colonies, all these things I've already mentioned, but I think it's just important to underscore that we, you know, have some power to, you know, change you know, the discourse, because we don't have to, you know, live this way, right? And the hope that I have is that, you know, through, and I have been so empowered by the projects that I've written about in terms of the way they have reach. You know, I mean, every time I see, you know, Jennifer and Guillermo's film, I just feel like it's very moving, right? And it's very powerful to think about, you know, generosity, you know, to think about love, and to think about that as part of our future too. So, but maybe the Cosmo Los Angeles might be them.
I thought a lot about this, because there is, when you're talking about space stuff, you're talking about communicating with aliens or whatever, like you can kind of have two camps. One is that, like, if somebody is hanging around in space, they probably have some idea of physics, and they have a bunch of the same conceptual stuff that you have. It might take a really different form, but it would be commensurable because you're kind of doing the same thing. And if there's a commensurability, then there is a possibility of some kind of exchange, which then implies some kind of possibility of a cosmo-humanism, or what I think about a lot is like a radical version of what Fanon was proposing with this new humanist kind of stuff. And extending that to the parrots and to the aliens and to wherever you want, to the Earth, to other planets. On the other hand, you have like that, no, that is not possible, that is not possible, the universe and Earth is radically other, and there is a kind of humility that we must have in the incommensurability, right? And because that, if you imagine that there's this commensurability, that is gonna turn into a colonialism. Right. So I don't know, but I want to bring that back to you, what you just said, because I'm wondering if you're thinking about this question of humanism in an expanded sense. That is something that you run up against when you are talking about space, when you're, whether that's, you know, the whole Earth or like, communicating with other people.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly driven by humans. but I mean, you know, that gets into the fairly paradox in terms of like, why are we doing SETI? What is the interest in broadcasting our, you know, language to the world that we have? And I think this gets, you know, this was the critique even when Stuart Brand edited a collection in 1977 called Space Colonies, where there were many people at that time that were wondering, why are we interested in this when there's so many problems here on Earth that we need to solve first, you know? And so, yeah, in terms of the kind of post-humanist thing, like thinking about like a kind of, you know, exchange that would be, you know, more generous, more loving, you know, but also that may not necessarily be mediated by technology at all, you know. And I think that's something that many artists are sort of like, you can push through, you know, and maximize, you know, with the kind of Fullerian logic of like the technological utopianism, utilitarianism, or you can also have, you know, like maybe a kind of fantasy of a sort of more blended way of thinking. I mean, something like George Clinton comes in there. It's like maybe space is a big party and the brood is like the metaphor that we need to get into about like a sort of collectivity that might not, you know, I don't think he was speculating as a post-humanist, maybe that dog song from Pow Wow 1983 and 1984. But yeah, to think though is like maybe we can like expand the notion, you know, the mothership connection, not just in his way, but that was a way to kind of to chart, to follow up with Sun Ra's vision of the Ark as something that you reclaim from Egypt, but also that, you know, thinks about the, you know, the fundamental like critique, I guess, if you could say, of Afrofuturism is that we are already living in an alien situation, right? Like, the Middle Passage was nothing more than like a, you know, like societies ripped apart and like, you know, made into genetic mutants, you know, and it's like an alien reality. And so maybe acceptance of that and like the kind of George Clinton ways to say like maybe we're all this kind of, you know, poly thing, you know, of the brood, and that, you know, it's not so much waiting, as Sun Ra said, for like, you know, deliverance away back to Saturn, but to think like you're waiting for the mothership connection to bring, you know, to bring the party. So maybe we'll end there.
So there is a book signing over there, to my left and your right. Abel will be signing books. I want to thank you, Abel, for including me in this. Thank you.
Happy birthday to you.